from MIT's Office of Digital Learning. This is Climate Conversations by ClimateX. I'm your host, Rajesh Kasturirangan. Welcome to Climate Conversations, the ClimateX podcast. This is our first podcast. We are broadcasting live from MIT, right in the heart of Kendall Square in Cambridge. I'm joined here by Dave Damlour.
Hi, everybody. Glad to be here.
And Kurt Newton.
Hello, hello.
And later in this episode, I'll be joined by Laura Howells, ClimateX's content and growth strategist. I am Rajesh Kasturirangan. We are about to share what we think are some of the most interesting ideas on trying to address climate change.
We're going to start by talking amongst ourselves, because what's more interesting than that?
Indeed. Who doesn't like listening to themselves? So every week in Climate Conversations, we are going to cover some of the most interesting news that has transpired that week. And I have to say that this week, in fact, this very minute, almost.
It's auspicious, isn't it?
I would not call it auspicious, yeah. But we have probably the biggest news item that we will ever cover on ClimateX, and that being?
Donald Trump announcing that the United States is pulling out of the Paris Agreement, we think.
That's going to be huge.
Yeah. What do you guys think? Like, is it the big deal? Is it the Armageddon that people are talking about?
I think it's a wonderful opportunity for other countries to step forward. China, India, the European Union, others around the world to take the leadership, to fill the leadership vacuum that Trump is creating.
Yeah, it's not like there was any question what his ground level intent was around all this stuff. I feel like it's, hey, let's
But did
make
you
it
really think that he was going to do it, Kurt?
I was kind of 50-50 on it because, you know, I think there's some interesting optics around keeping the seat at the table, right?
That Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State and former CEO of ExxonMobil, was promoting.
Think of the mischief that one can propagate with
if,
that
if
seat at the table.
If you're not at the table, you can't throw, eggs at other people who are at the
not
table.
Not quite the same way. So no. I'm like, great, you know, let's have it be clear.
Mm-hmm. But still, I mean, do you really believe it's happening? I mean, it is happening, but
it blows my mind.
I do. I totally understand why it's happening, because it's a false dichotomy that some folks, Trump and people in his administration, are promoting. And part of what we can do is to blow up that false dichotomy and show it for how false it is.
Okay. Well, where do you speculation think
you go from time. Yeah.
What do you think is going to happen next?
Well, China is already positioning itself for leadership, world leadership, and they're, I think, setting the stage for major breakthroughs in wind technology, solar technology. They've already helped bring down the unit costs of most of those renewable technologies, and they're going to go even further.
Yeah, and I think here in the United States, the subnational actors, the states, the regions, the cities, mm-hmm. you know, it's going to be inconsistent from place to place, but boy, it's been clear for quite a while that there's a tremendous amount of momentum, regardless of what the federal government does or doesn't do. It would sure be more awesome if the federal government was with it, but the momentum's not going to stop.
So tell me, do you think this is going to make the red versus blue divide worse or better?
I believe that it will make it better, actually. Because
wow.
Okay.
Tell me why.
I look for this to be an environment where kind of communities draw together, and make progress in a way that can kind of show the reluctant communities that hey, this is actually a good thing. You know, we're going to continue to deploy renewables. We're going to take better care of our communities. What's not to like about that, whether you believe in climate change or not?
So, Kurt, you're from Iowa, from a farming background. I think lots of people in that world vote for Trump. Mm-hmm. But if you're a farmer and you need water, you need other inputs, you want to make sure that you have a livelihood.
Yep.
does it really matter whether you're Republican or not? I mean, climate is going to affect you, and what are you going to do about it?
Yeah, it matters deeply. And so, you know, when it comes down to it, you know, I think communities in the heartland are, you know, who, you know, people's livelihoods are so dependent on the natural world and the weather. They're paying attention to that. You know, they also, understandably, in a lot of cases, have some hesitation about big solutions being mandated on them. And so the world that we're heading into here in the United States is a lot more kind of regional, state-based, locally based. Iowa, while it voted big for Trump, is also the leading deployment state, I believe, of wind power.
Oh, so, that's where I'd like to jump in, because if you saw the current issue of Technology Review from MIT, there's a really good article there about Texas. And Texas is, in fact, the biggest producer of electricity from wind turbines. And it's a very interesting institutional story. Now, Texas is a blue state, right?
Red state.
Oh, sorry. I got my colors wrong here. So they're making business decisions based on income streams and other hard-nosed business considerations in terms of investing. And they have not been able to put together as much technology, get it on the ground as they would like. And what they're bumping up against is the technology constraints, for example, with storage. So the wind goes and goes, especially at night out there in West Texas. They're generating a lot of electricity, but sometimes they have no place to go with it. And even though they would like to be paying the utilities to take it, the utilities say, we don't have the capacity. So they've got technology constraints where MIT and other smart technology folks, I think, can make a difference in terms of transmission capacity and storage.
I want to step back a little bit and go into an imagined future and ask, like, yes, political divisions are real. There are all kinds of people who disagree with each other. But there should be a genuine and authentic way in which climate action is not just bipartisan in the American sense, but it's a worldwide human challenge.
Yeah.
Right? We can all agree on. So my point is that if a meteor, like an asteroid, was about to hit the Earth, it's not human caused, but we would all be working together to do something about it, I hope, right? In the same way, it frankly doesn't matter to me whether climate change is caused by humans or not. It's real, and
so
it's happening.
Let's get adapting, yeah?
Exactly.
Yeah. What do you think is going to happen there, Rajesh?
I think that we're going to eventually start working together seriously. And initiatives, and I'm not saying ClimateX is going to be, you know, the defining solution.
Oh, come on.
Oh, of course ClimateX is going to be. Who am I kidding? Right? ClimateX is going to be the solution. No. But I do think that in the next 5 years or less, we will see more and more alliances cutting across boundaries that we did not think could ever be bridged.
Yeah,
here. And we need to be building systems that can take advantage of that.
So one of the things that I've been thinking about recently, and this came up in a conversation just now again, is how on earth to engage people who don't see their lives as personally affected by climate change. And for me, the ticket here is to talk about food. Because, well, no surprise here, everybody's got to eat every day. Breakfast, lunch, dinner, snacks, whatever.
I eat only once every 3 days.
Oh, okay. So you're
that
an exception.
That explains a lot.
Yeah. Thanks for good to know that. And if you look at how our food is produced and what we're eating, you get a lot of clues to the causes of climate change, whether it's in fertilizer production and use, whether it's in raising cattle for beef, or water runoff from farms, or anything, food choices that people make up and down all around. So I think this is fodder, so to speak, for good conversation about climate in terms of not abstract, not polar bears, not 50 years from now, but right here and now.
And it's also, it's distinctly, it's not completely non-technological, but So many people, when they think about climate change solutions, they go to renewable energy. And while that's important, you know, shifting agricultural practices gets deeply cultural and into people's behaviors, both as consumers and these, you know, these amazing business practices that we've developed over thousands of years about how the heck do we grow our food and support ourselves. That's a rich vein to mine, and looking forward to doing a lot of work on that in the podcast.
And you know, many of us have heard of Project Drawdown, which is the best and most easily implementable solutions to the climate crisis. And surprise, surprise, many of them turn out to be food-related and are not technologically complex to implement, but it's going to mean eating differently and drinking differently and growing differently.
Replenishing the soil, yeah. All of that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and those things are all, there's lots more we can learn about it, but the starting points are pretty clear, and people are doing some really, really interesting work on, kind of smaller scale deployments in places including Iowa. Yeah.
Eat less beef.
Yeah, for sure. You know,
and community supported agriculture has taken hold in Massachusetts. I mean, anybody can get a farm share out in Lincoln, North Shore, South Shore, even in Allendale Farm in my hometown of Brookline here.
We'll get them for underwriting soon.
All right. Now let's move to the other end of the solution spectrum, because you know there are things that you can do on your own, and then there are things that we can do to the earth at such a large scale that some of us might not be ready for. And what I'm talking about is geoengineering, because we got a couple questions from our users on, can we talk about geoengineering on ClimateX? And of course we can. But we're not going to agree on what to do about it. So, yeah. Kurt, what do you think?
Yeah, that's the nature of it. I think it's a fascinating kind of situation we're posed with, right? It, as soon as you open it up, it brings some really profound ethical, moral, political dimensions to it. You know, where I think human interventions in the natural world have a long and unfortunate history with unforeseen consequences. And so that's led a lot of, you know, well thoughtful people to be very, very cautious about this. And I think the moment they're at right now is really interesting, because what people seem to be advocating for when they're pushing for some progress on geoengineering is, we just better cover our bets, among other things.
I was going to use a different vowel there.
And learn a little bit more, just in case, you know, several things like Trump pulling out of Paris, you know, transpire over the next few years to cover ourselves in case we need to take drastic action.
For me, it's really risky to think about this, and yeah. I would need to see a lot more definitive risk assessments before I could get comfortable with this, because it seems like another, you know, MIT generated kind of idea from technologists for a silver bullet that will get us out of this enormous mess that we're in without having to change our behaviors.
Do you think people actually look at it that way? I mean, it's all
the boys and their toys. That's what I'm thinking.
You know, every time I see it brought up in conversation, it's like, all we want to do is just learn a little bit more about it. And God, we have so much more work to do before we would try to get into a real deployment.
So yeah. I have a different take.
Yeah.
And I want to be deliberately controversial.
Oh,
right? Right? I feel like geoengineering is not ambitious enough. Right? I feel like because ultimately, so think about it this way. The United States is a large country, and you may want to connect the two ends of the country by railroads or roads or planes, but what you really need is a governance system that can handle a nation that large and then provide the moral and political infrastructure to make those roads happen, right? That's why it's called the Eisenhower highway system. And I think that before we have geoengineering, we need geocracy, right? We need a way to actually understand how we are going to manage the whole Earth before populating it with solutions, which I think at some point or the other we might have to consider, but we need a very large political and moral vision before we need engineering solutions.
That's a really interesting idea. I think we're going to want to play that out over a number of weeks. You know, geoengineering as the means to a bigger, higher end. Huh. You heard it here first.
So, Laura, you have been listening to us talk our mouths off. You know how hard it is to get us to stop. But we've been discussing wild ideas, geoengineering, Trump pulling out of the Paris Agreement. What is your take?
Well, as someone with a deep interest in climate change, but I would say, to put it mildly, no formal education in climate change and science, I'm wondering maybe what I'm going to start at the real basics. What is geoengineering, and how can I be interested, get involved in it?
You want to take a run at that, Rajesh?
So geoengineering is making large-scale changes to either the atmosphere or the oceans, so changing the composition of the natural environment in such a way that it reduces carbon. So it could mean literally sucking carbon out of the atmosphere and putting it into very large tunnels dug deep into the earth. So it is large-scale intervention in the natural system.
Yeah, and the stuff that's been in the news very much recently is a trial that's going ahead, I believe, next year by David Keith and some of his colleagues up in the atmosphere to, test a chemical way of putting kind of a shield around the earth to minimize how much sun heating would come in, basically reflective particles up there.
So a little bit more than recycling my waste on the weekends and composting when I get a chance. It's a scary, I mean, to me, that sounds somewhat terrifying, I guess. How much regulation is there? Like, is this something that's definitely going to go ahead? And will people who aren't climate experts at places like MIT know about this?
So, you know what I want to do is set off one of those volcanoes in the middle of the Pacific.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly where...
For fun or...
Yeah. That's the volcano thing is exactly, I think, the right metaphor. I mean, that's the process the volcanoes set off in the atmosphere, That's like the analogy. The Earth does
this
kind of stuff, right?
Right.
And we know what happens when a volcano goes off. Sometimes it can be devastating, but if we could do it just a little bit and keep some control over it.
I believe that it happened. There was one in the 17th century.
Oh, there was the Philippines.
Well, that was the Krakatoa.
Yeah.
I think in the 17th century, there was a big volcano, I forgot where, which reduced temperatures for a long time and I think led to famines in many parts of the world.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it affected Europe, even though the volcano was on the other side of the world. Mount Pinatubo was fairly recent, and, science has a much kind of closer view of what happened in the Earth system at that point. So that's a...
My question would be, if this is something that we're talking about, like sucking carbon dioxide out of the air, and who owns this? Like, who is responsible for making these decisions? Can it be done on a country-by-country basis if you're affecting global atmospheres?
That's a great question.
Thanks.
Yeah.
But, it actually brings the complementary question, which is, who owns the emissions right now, right? Because, we're talking about large-scale shifts to the atmosphere deliberately, but we're kind of doing that already, which is why we have climate change in the first place. Yeah. So what does it mean? Suppose that you order a car and it's manufactured in 100 different countries in the world, transported after burning fossil fuels, which in turn, who is responsible for that emission?
Yeah, is it where? Yeah. I remember reading about something in the UK about apples that were grown in Spain, shipped to England to be cleaned, shipped back to Spain to be shined, and then back to England to be sold, or something insane like that, where all these processes were so separated across different countries. And, as a result, there are huge emissions. Is it the country producing them, buying them, cleaning them? Who is responsible for that?
And I think part of this is monitoring and quantitatively measuring all the contributions, yeah. right? Like mm-hmm. it's not just the dollar value at the end. You have to put not just a price, but a number that calculates exactly where, what, and how.
Yeah, there's a CliMedX post I want to work up on this subject. Some interesting research that's been done recently that suggests something like 10%, if I'm remembering correctly. This is a Brad Plummer article in Vox last month. About 10% of emissions from China are, you know, generating stuff consumed by other countries.
Oh, so interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, as someone who hasn't got the resources and education, I guess, educational experience to be completing this kind of high-level research and getting involved on that kind of scale, what would you say are the best ways for me as an individual or me within my community in Massachusetts, where I live? What's the best way for me to get involved in climate action?
Join ClimateX.
Yeah, other than join ClimateX and create a page and start discussions, what else can I do?
Well, you know, one of the things that we want to do with ClimateX is make it easier for people to meet like-minded folks, you know? So what's an aspect of climate change that you're most interested in or most connected to, like food or?
Good question. Yeah. I think for me, it's politics. So I'm a UK born and a Green Party voter through and through, and have always consistently voted on the side of climate action. So I guess, what can I do that works through ClimateX that allows me to capitalize on that? Or what could we introduce possibly as something within ClimateX that allows people to get involved in the politics of climate change?
So at least in Massachusetts, there are lots of towns, right? So we live in the Boston area, but there are many, many towns. And I think at a town level, you can have a pretty major impact if there are just even 25 or 50 of you who are willing to do something together, right? Cool. You can get a council person elected with that kind of margin.
And right, like, I mean, I'm very new to the area, so I'm not up to date with the kind of action that might be going on in Cambridge, MIT, Massachusetts as a whole. So I suppose I want to know sometimes where I can find this kind of action, where I can find these people. And that's the challenge, I suppose, bringing people together when we're facing a lot of political discord.
Yeah, well, we hope that as the ClimateX membership grows, you'll find more and more of those sort of colleagues here on the platform.
Definitely. More people who don't quite know what they're talking about but want to say something.
Right. We love that.
Right. Yeah. And I think that even though we need system-wide changes, there's no doubt about it. Like, we need changes at the national and international level. But I think people should get used to climate being part of their own political experience of the world, right? And that's best done at the local level.
And like, I think from having experienced ClimateX and like looked at the activity on the site and seen what's going on, there's people who are, like you guys, experts in this subject matter. You are involved in different ways in the really high level thinking, which is great for me to learn about. But then I can also connect with people who are like me. They might live in the same area, they might have some of the same interests. I can, you know, look at other things going on in terms of climate politics. So I suppose for me, it's, I enjoy the aspect of being able to learn from the experts and talk to the people like me, who I don't know how what to call us other than non-experts. So yeah, it's a good place for collaboration.
Yeah, you know, knowing how to, you know, bringing the questions that you have is such a key part of this whole enterprise, right? And I think we firmly believe that everybody who's getting involved in ClimateX knows things, and the questions that they're asking are what makes this whole engine run.
So, MIT can be it's so reputable and respected, and because of that, a little bit scary sometimes. You know, I know that when you come to MIT, you're going to be talking with thought leaders and experts, and you know, that can be a little bit intimidating. So it's nice knowing that there's other people like me who can ask questions, and you know, it's a friendly place for them to be answered.
Just ask questions. I think that's you know,
yeah. Don't be scared of feeling stupid.
Yeah, and I think that MIT, while it does have that forbidding reputation, I think is a place which appreciates questioning and hard questioning.
Yeah. Nice.
All right. So we are at the end of our first climate conversation. Thank you so much, Kurt and Dave and Laura.
That was really fun.
Yeah. And if you have any questions, you can always email us at climatex_feedback. So climatex_feedback@mit.edu, or visit us on the web at climatex.mit.edu. Sign up and start participating yourself.
Yeah. I'll also make a plug for our social media feeds. We're on Twitter and Facebook, and you can get access to those through the website.
We cover a lot of topics on ClimateX, and there's no such thing as a dumb question, so let it rip.
All right, so I'm going to end with a question. Wait, is it? I don't know if it's a dumb question or not, but tell me a happy thought that we can, you know, take into the rest of the week.
Yeah, so, like something good that happened this week, yes. Climate-wise?
Yeah, that'd be great to hear.
ExxonMobil shareholders pushed through and actually by a substantial margin, 62%, to push the company to, you know, produce a climate risk assessment, a detailed climate risk assessment. And people have been working towards this for years and years and years. And I think that's a substantial victory for the climate action movement.
Hear, hear.
And it comes on the heels of Occidental Petroleum mm-hmm. and Chevron doing something similar through shareholder action. Yeah. So there is hope.
Yeah.
Right. I actually have a more local piece of news, which is our friend and MIT alum, Quentin Zondervan, is standing for Cambridge City Council. And if you are in Cambridge, vote for him.
Hear, hear.
See you next week.
Climate Conversations is brought to you by MIT's ClimateX, an online community dedicated to solving the climate crisis. Visit us at climatex.mit.edu and join the conversation.